Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I am happy to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Michael Nagler. He is the founder and president of the Metta Center for Nonviolence. See Metta Center, METTA Center.org. He co-founded the Peace and Conflict Studies program at UC Berkeley, where he is Professor Emeritus of Classics and Comparative Literature. And the reason for bringing Michael Nagler on this show is that he is the author of the brand new book, The Nonviolence Handbook, A Guide for Practical Action. And it is indeed that. Michael Nagler, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Much, David. Yes, I'm very glad to be here.
It's terrific to have you on, and it is a terrific book. I highly recommend it to people as something to be used and carried around and consulted. It's full of advice and examples. It begins with an introduction to what nonviolent action is. Why don't we begin there as well? What is nonviolent activism, and what is satyagraha?
Yeah, very well, that's a perfect place to begin, of course. And from my point of view, and I guess I belong to a set of people who hold this vision, if you will, that nonviolence begins within. And what that means in concrete terms is that we develop a capacity to roll over or convert negative, destructive drives, you know, like anger, resentment, and fear, into correspondingly positive drives. And then we learn to express that in relationships, and that goes all the way out from interpersonal relationships to intergroup, intrasocial, international relationships of humanity with the planet. All of these are affected by that capacity to do the inner conversion and the knowledge of how to express that in the outer world, because we do not get much of that knowledge in our culture. Our culture is replete with excellent advice on how to be violent. You know, once we've been pumped up to be violent by a violent mass media, then we can learn how to build bombs, buy cheap guns, whatever. But to actually learn which strategies and which techniques work best when you're trying to interact with others nonviolently, that's something we have to learn cognitively. It does not come from our mass media. So that's the point of the Nonviolence Handbook. We've collected best practices and the theoretical explanations for them that we've garnered over the years and condensed them into this little book, which, as you were kind enough to say, David, is designed to be carried around and consulted and referred to for people like many people today who are caught up in a nonviolent campaign or a movement, or even just a brief one-off episode, but they don't exactly know what to look for to evaluate, did it work, did I do it right, and they don't know how to follow it up, if it's successful, and so forth. So we have all of those tips in there.
It sounds probably to some listeners initially as a little bit irrelevant or even self-indulgent when you look at a government where we're unable to unelect anybody or influence its behavior, a military-industrial complex, the likes of which the world has never seen before, waging war after war, and we're going to look into our inner hearts, and we're going to become less angry, and we're going to be more sociable with our neighbors, and so forth. How do you make a connection between the two? How does it become relevant?
Very good question, and quite an important question, because if that can't be answered in the affirmative, then we might as well just give up and go home. Well, I guess I would approach it this way, that those governments and those networks of corporations and the military-industrial complex, they're able to do what they do because they are supported by a decent enough swath of the public, and because that swath of the public that supports that kind of thing does so because of the way they see the world. They see the world as a dangerous place full of separate competing individuals and groups. And they are utterly unaware, for the most part, that they have the deeper resources within themselves. So the book does not advocate just that you become Mr. Nice Guy then go home and pat yourself on the back. On the contrary, it's when you've set up these transformers in your own consciousness to deal with your own anger and fear, you're very well equipped to deal with the anger and fear of others, and then you can learn how to bring that out in effective action. And one of the things that I didn't have time to really go into very much in the book, but I mention it, is that we need to change what's called the story or the narrative about where the world came from and who we are and what capacities we have and where we're going. And it's an opportune time to do that, just as I know you believe that it's an opportune time to take on the war system. It's an opportune time to change the story, and I think those two things have to go hand in hand. And the reason it's opportune is that for the first time since the church condemned Galileo to house arrest because he told a truth about the solar system, for the first time, this powerful knowledge-collecting mechanism, this learning tool called science, and the ancient wisdom tradition that all human groups are heir to, the first time in hundreds of years here in the West that those two are starting to combine, to coincide around the same message. And that message is that we are body, mind, and spirit, and we are, you know, deeply set up in our nervous systems and so forth to benefit from compassion and to be responsive to empathy and be empathetic towards one another. And all those things have been more or less neglected. But science over just the last 20, 25 years, a little more maybe, scientists from every discipline have gotten fascinated by this new picture of humanity that's emerging. So we've been proposing that anybody who wants to work on peace should learn the new story that's emerging, you know, assimilate some of its main points, and don't hesitate to use that story to explain to your friends and neighbors what you're doing. You know, if somebody says, well, we have to put 25% of the world's prison population has to be from our country because the only way we can be secure, we point out that animals and early human groups and now many, many little networks of restorative justice are achieving much greater levels of security by having restorative practices instead of retributive practices. And here's why. Because as partly spiritual beings, we are deeply interconnected, and well, we're not locked into competition for scarce resources and so forth. So I see this as a very powerful way for the movement to go forward, first of all, to become more cohesive in its impact on society, and second of all, to just keep on articulating this new picture, which is backed up by science, backed up by wisdom, and I could easily imagine that there would be a tipping point where the culture would change over to a much more inspiring and encouraging narrative of what a human being is. At that point, all of our work will become easier.
Presumably, those of us who are 1,000% in favor of compassion and empathy and a better vision of what humanity can be and should be, but don't find ourselves attracted to the term spiritual and don't find religion to be helpful in these things, can participate as well.
Yes, certainly they can. They could rely on the scientific evidence, and there's no need to bring in the term spiritual. I'm sure you're familiar, for example, with this book by Maria Stephan and Erica Chenoweth, which just proves, using the methods of political science, that nonviolent insurrections are twice as successful as violent insurrections. And we're seeing this played out in a particularly horrific way in Syria right now. So, yeah, no, there's no need to invoke God language or anything else, but just to accept that there are dimensions of our existence which are beyond our material bodies, and that we can learn to operate in and on those levels, just as we've learned so spectacularly to operate on the outside world here in the West.
Erica Chenoweth has been a past guest on Talk Nation Radio, and anyone who missed that program can go to the website and go back and listen to it. That is an excellent piece of research that she's produced. A lot of the what seems very helpful in your book, Michael Nagler, in presenting a different vision of humanity are stories of actual incidents, of actual nonviolent campaigns and actions in the past that you use as examples of what to do and what not to do. And one of the examples you use early in the book is from 1968 in Prague. And I began to see some similarities to actions just in recent weeks in Ukraine. I'm wondering if you can remind us what happened in Prague and whether you see any similarities as well.
Yeah, thank you. Incidentally, David, there are, for every story that's in that book, there are hundreds more that are stacked up waiting to be told. And in fact, my editors asked me to cut out a bunch of stories in order to make this a small and easily accessible book. So people should feel very confident that those stories are representative and they're not flukes at all. Well, what happened in what was called Prague Spring was there was a reform movement going on. Alexander Dubček became president of Czechoslovakia, and they were starting to create what they called, I think, communism with a human face or socialism with a human face. And the Kremlin took a dim view of this and mounted an invasion of Czechoslovakia in spring of 1968 from three directions. The invasion force totaled 500,000 troops. The Czechs knew right away that they couldn't possibly defend themselves with force, and it, with the exception of a few sporadic incidents, nobody even tried. But the Czechs are good-humored people. They're pretty well united at that point, and they were very, very much engaged in keeping their experiment going and giving them a lot of hope. So they decided to stay together and not obey, but not, you know, not comply, but not resist with violence. So, for example, in one episode, which I think I mentioned in the book, they turned a lot of roadsides around and, you know, painted them over and stuff. So this huge invasion force comes over the Polish border heading for Prague, and they drive and drive all day, and they find themselves right back at the border where they came from. And by and large, as far as was humanly possible in such a situation, the Czechs tried to relate to the Soviet, the Warsaw Pact troops, as people and not as enemies. So they rejected their enemy identity. They looked past their uniforms and tried to speak to them as people. And the result of that was a takeover, which was scheduled by military experts in the Kremlin to have been accomplished in 4 days. It dragged on for 8 months. And the only way it was finally overcome was by couple of different kinds of subterfuge. The Czech leaders were invited to Moscow and just more or less forced to sign a kind of surrender. It was a very, very sad event. And at the same time, they brought in troops that were not from neighboring countries and couldn't understand Czech. So, you know, and they told these troops, there's a counter-revolution, you've got to go in and suppress it. So after 8 months, the movement was brought to a close, but nobody, well, almost nobody died in the process. And almost more importantly, the Czechs had gotten a taste of what you could do with nonviolence. So then in the early 90s, when the Iron Curtain did come down, and some Eastern European countries experienced horrific violence, like Romania would be possibly the worst, the Czechs had this velvet revolution, and everything went down smoothly. And that's one of the big points I try to make in the book, is that that nonviolence consists of constructive program as well as satyagraha. And constructive program enables you to build up the needed infrastructure of your new society before you bring down the old, so that you don't get into the situation that happened in Egypt, for example, where, yes, you can get a dictator out of power, but then unless you are ready to go with the institutions that society needs, reactionary forces will rush into that power vacuum. So the Czechs, on a cultural level and in some institutional ways, they realized that they had stumbled on something called nonviolence and that it could be deployed in other situations. And it was there for them when they needed to make that transition.
That's an excellent expansion on the story that is told more briefly in the book, along with many other examples. But in recent weeks, we saw the government of Ukraine send troops and tanks eastward into eastern Ukraine, and we saw them stopped by unarmed people and engaged in conversation and food and drink with the people that they were supposedly sent to attack. This is not a sort of experience that a nation that fights wars with missiles from drones tends to have.
Of course, that's one of the worst things about modern warfare, is it's been so dehumanized and so depersonalized. It's interesting to note that even some drone operators who never actually see their victims and never interact with them on a personal level have nonetheless been sickened by what they have to do, and they've walked out on the job. I have a friend, a psychologist by the name of Rachel McNair, who's coined this term perpetration-induced traumatic stress, which means that when you hurt another person, you hurt yourself. And this is something that can now be starting at least to be studied and documented scientifically. And as I say, it's interesting that even when you try to remove yourself from the horror and the pain that you're causing, as human beings, we nonetheless register that. And that's why we're seeing such an appallingly high level of suicide among troops over recent 10 or so years. It's an unprecedented, more, and now far more, we passed a point 3 years ago, I think, where more American soldiers had committed suicide than had been killed in combat. And so if we had a nonviolent framework around as an alternative window to look at all of this through, we might be able to see that this is the handwriting on the wall for the war system, that we cannot go on doing this to ourselves, much less to other people, and we must come up with an alternative. And that alternative is called nonviolence.
At the Meta Center, you have a project underway called the Roadmap Project that I understand is intended to point us in the right directions. Can you describe that work?
Yeah, thank you for mentioning it, David. We're very inspired and enthusiastic about Roadmap. Its purpose was to collect together the energies of the innumerable disparate projects that you are probably familiar with. Paul Hawkins' book, Blessed Unrest, where he argues that there must be over a million organizations doing wonderful things, but they have not become a movement. So the first purpose was to just create a diagram that we call the mandala, and could be seen on our website, metacenter.org, meta with two T's. And it's a very attractive diagram design that kind of shows in six sectors where the various problems are that we are now operating on, and it shows concentric circles building out from inner empowerment, which is where we started our conversation, to constructive program, to nonviolent direct action resistance, or satyagraha. So that was the first phase of Roadmap, and that's been available for a couple of years now, and we're now building what's called a compass, which is going to be an interactive tool so that people can get in touch with other people who are doing the same thing, wherever they are in the country or, in fact, abroad. And the third phase, which is really just in the notional phase at this point, would be a strategy creation. You know, we're probably going to adopt a version of the model that the Sri Lankan Sarvodaya movement came up with about 30 years ago, which was called a 500-year plan for peace, where they looked 500 years into the future to an idyllic planet with Sri Lanka thriving and blooming as a natural paradise and a human paradise. And then they backed down from there and said, okay, to get there in 500 years, what do we have to do in 400 years? And so on, so forth. So we're going to adopt that probably and maybe go out 100 years and then develop a strategy for the movement as a whole, or what's sometimes called a movement of movements, where you would pick winnable events or issues. For example, one trajectory that I've had in my mind is we could complete the picture of getting restorative justice into schools. Because that's something that's going on. It doesn't seem to be too threatening to the system. And it's people's kids, after all. They don't want to be hurting them and punishing them unnecessarily. So if in, I don't know, let's say 10 years, we had restorative justice in the schools, then we could use that successful experiment to say to the general public, by the way, this could also work in the criminal justice system. And, of course, we would back that up with the succinct version of the news story that we mentioned earlier. So some point beyond that, we could convert the United States, which is one of the worst offenders in this regard, convert our country to a restorative justice system. And then that stepping stone would put us in a position to do away with war. That's where I think people have the most fear and the least sympathy for the other. So we could conceivably build up to that stepwise. And this would be a strategy that anybody doing anything around the great mandala would be welcome to participate in. So that's the idea. And if people go to metacenter.org, you'll see roadmap pop up right there on our homepage, I believe. And in any case, you can get to the compass and let us know if you're interested. And we are right now working on perfecting that interactive tool so we can all form a vibrant community and an unstoppable movement.
One example of an attempt to build a more comprehensive movement that comes up in your book in a number of places was, of course, Occupy, which you cite as, I think, tell me if I'm wrong, something with great potential, although you use examples from particular Occupy encampments as what not to do as well as what to do. But what is your thinking on attempts to continue to move mm-hmm. in the direction of a bigger, stronger Occupy movement?
You know, it's already moving in that direction here and there. And then I think I mentioned a couple of constructor program operations that have developed out of Occupy. And one was called Occupy Sandy, where they were doing hurricane relief in the New York area. And another, which I really like, is called Occupy Jubilee, I believe.
Yes.
What they're doing is buying up people's debts for pennies on the dollar and then setting the people free. So it's a direct constructive thrust at the heart of the financial system, which is what sparked Occupy in the first place. And I also see two encouraging developments. One is that during Occupy, there was a lot of fuss made about, quote, diversity of tactics, unquote. And I put that phrase in quotes because I think it was a complete misnomer. It was not diversity. It was the polar opposite. And it was not tactics, but underlying vision that they were threatening. In other words, these were people who said, well, we should use a little violence when that's appropriate. So that really vitiates the nonviolent character of a movement. You really cannot do that. And I think in the course of the Occupy episode, there were quite a number of people who recognized that and just not entertaining that distraction anymore. Now, the other thing, which might be might take longer to get this one accomplished, but I happen to think it's quite essential, is that, in the words of my friend Tom Hastings, decide how you're going to decide. One of the first things that any movement has to do. And what Occupy tried to do was to let all decisions emerge from the grassroots with really not any structure and without any leadership. And personally, I think that we need leadership, and it's perfectly possible to have leadership which is not undemocratic, which is not authoritarian. And in some ways, Gandhi was a very good example of a nonviolent leader who had authority without authoritarianism. And I noticed that, again, Erica Chenoweth has written about this, that the leaderless, completely leaderless experiment was useful insofar as it told us that that doesn't work very well. It's just hopelessly inefficient. So I could easily see Occupy as starting from its beachhead, if you will, the gross economic disparity between the slightly less than 1% and the vast majority of us. Yeah, let them start there, but let them reach out to resonate with other issues, which they'd be perfectly willing to do, and let them follow the inner to outer trajectory that we tried to lay out in Roadmap, where they make sure they never neglect personal empowerment, and where they look around for constructive ways of changing the system and train for the inevitable resistance or satyagraha that's going to have to be done against those parts of the system that have not yet yielded. And so what we wanted to point out to our colleagues and friends in Occupy is that in a way they started in a centripetal direction, you know, start with protest and face off against the police and do something illegal and be confrontational. And we would like them to reach that point in later when they're much better prepared for it. But I see no reason why the energies and the spirit of Occupy, somewhat channeled and matured and refocused, could not come about, maybe not in a single climactic wave, but in a slow, steady process, as long as it gets the job done.
And slow and steady, but fast enough to save this planet before we destroy it, would be the key.
That's the key.
This is excellent advice, and you can find much more of it in this book. And my advice is to get a copy and bring it to your next action, The Nonviolence Handbook, A Guide for Practical Action by Michael Nagler. Michael, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
David, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pure pleasure speaking with you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.